Oh, hey, how are you? Great to hear. Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable. Like a drink? Sure. There you go. Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin? It's time for another Tech Lounge with me, Christian Scheller. I took a week off last week. No real reason, to be perfectly honest with you. I just did. So, this episode, I am squashing two interviews into one, both related to containers. So a sort of classic Tech Lounge episode there. First, you will hear from Madhura from Platform 9, where we're talking a lot about their managed container platform, and specifically around migrating VMware to Platform 9 and containers and that kind of thing. Actually, Platform 9 have been around the container space for a while, so it was also an interesting conversation to just dig into that pathway, that journey for the company. And second, you will hear from John at Root.io, who do vulnerability scanning and things like that for images. And they come out of a company who I think I've had on the show before. Actually, the company that became Root have had quite a journey, and we talk about that too. So there we go, two container-related interviews that magically I managed to get to fit together. Wonderful. Before we begin, here's a word from the sponsor. I have been talking about and using Raycast almost since it began. It's a drop-in replacement for tools like Alfred and Spotlight, letting you do all sorts of productivity hacks such as opening applications, triggering commands, window resizing, and through a broad plugin ecosystem, all sorts of other things too. Some of my favorites are HomeKit devices, triggering shortcuts, and screen layouts, and also creating Trello cards because I happen to maintain that extension, actually. Raycast has a pro feature, lets you do all sorts of other things, including a lot of AI features and the ability to share workflows amongst other team members. So if you're interested in finding out more, getting a discount on a pro plan, and of course, earning a little bit for the show, then head on over to go.christianscheller.com/Raycast. Hey, Madhura, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Chris. How are you?
Good. Now, Platform 9, I feel like you have been around this space for a little while. I feel like I might even had some stickers or something for some time ago. So maybe let's have a quick little bit of company history first, because I feel like you've been around the Kubernetes, cloud native, etc. space for some time. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we were founded in late 2013, early 2014. Chris. Okay. So we have been around for some time. Prior to that, myself and my co-founders, we spent across the three of us almost three decades at VMware. So lots of enterprise systems experience. But then when we started with Platform 9, our goal was really to create a private cloud alternative, similar to what VMware has offered for its users for multiple years, but one that's built using best of breed open source technology, right? Mm-hmm. So we feel really passionately that open source is going to be leading the innovation for private and public clouds in the future. And we wanted to be a part of that ecosystem. And then the second aspect that was very important to us was enabling private clouds using the same agility that public clouds use by providing a SaaS-hosted management plane model. So it's sort of a hybrid model where we host the management software in the cloud, but you still run your service on premises. So it really provides a delightful experience where you don't have to worry about the management of the software itself that runs your cloud, but you still get the benefit of running your own hardware in your own data center. So that's really how the company started. And then over the time, we have built our private cloud platform using best of breed virtualization, open source technology, but also Kubernetes. And those two are key parts of our stack today.
Let's quickly, because VMware is one of these things that I think if you know it, you know it. But especially if you come from a sort of open source world, you've heard of it, but maybe you don't really know what it is. So what is VMware is a company, but but you know, what does VMware do in this space? Or what did they do? I think more crucially we have to talk about. But yeah. So what were people using VMware for in this sort of cloud native space the past few years?
Yeah. So I mean, before cloud native even became relevant, right? VMware really became the word VMware became almost synonymous to VMs, so virtual machines, because they were the pioneers. They really, you know, created a mainstream version of VMs, so virtualization. And the core IP that VMware built over multiple decades, and it still remains strong in the industry, is they built a hypervisor called ESXi, which was, I would say, the first sort of commercial hypervisor that enabled enterprises to take their physical servers, which back then most of the infrastructure was run using physical servers, and transform them into virtualized environments, right? And then they kept building on top of that. They built probably the first virtualization management platform, and they built a lot of features like live migrating virtual machines, you know, fault tolerance for virtual machines, high availability. So they've invested a lot of IP, which is used by enterprises today to run large-scale virtualized environments, right? Mm. That's really the core product offering from VMware. And that's very popular in enterprises even today that run large-scale private cloud environments, right? So equivalent of what you do in the public cloud, but using your data centers.
Okay, so it's primarily for people who want to run their own data center, whatever that may mean, because it doesn't necessarily mean they have their own building or something like that. But it's not in the kind of three hyperscalers, basically.
That's exactly right.
In a very brief summary, it's a bit abstracted, but yeah. Okay. And right. Why, I guess, up until, you know, people wanting to move away from VMware is something that has people have mentioned a few times in the past year or so. Well, let's go back a little bit first. Up until about a year or so ago, why might people have wanted to move away? Was it just a kind of wanting to have more agility? Was it wanting to get on to Kubernetes with all the cool kids? Or like, what were the reasons that people might want to actually migrate away?
Yeah, so I think prior to VMware's acquisition of Broadcom, the primary reasons for moving away from VMware were reduction of cost, or being more aligned to a more cloud-native way of managing your infrastructure. Because VMware APIs, their constructs for managing virtualized environments were still pre-cloud-native. And so you necessarily didn't have the best self-service experience, the best REST APIs to automate your infrastructure, you know, the cloud-native, public cloud-like constructs to manage your environments. And so those were the two popular reasons for customers or enterprises leaving VMware back then.
Okay. And then you already kind of got to the punchline, but there was this Broadcom acquisition, which, and this is sort of when a few people started saying, oh, the pricing was going to change and there's some terms changes. Some of that, I think, came true. Some of it didn't. But yeah, what changed for customers after that acquisition that maybe accelerated some people wanting to move?
Yeah, you know, I think multiple factors changed, right? And we really see this sort of massive overhaul happening past the Broadcom acquisition. And some of it, I think everybody anticipated, but it's as it has actually happened or has been rolling out, it has been pretty massive in how many enterprises are being impacted by it and how many are actually actively looking for an alternative solution, right? So the primary thing that impacted a majority of customers is the price increase. It's been a significant price increase that's been, you know, talked about publicly, 3 to 4x, sometimes up to almost 10x. But also there's a trust factor, right? And there is definitely a portion of enterprises that may not trust that this won't be the only time that this is going to happen. You know, there is the fear that there's going to be a pattern now for every renewal. There's going to be at least, you know, 25-30% or so.
Okay, yeah.
That's really, that makes it difficult. Yeah, because at that point, if you compare your private cloud total cost of ownership to public cloud with the massive price increase that, you know, VMware has now done, it no longer is significantly cost effective to run your private cloud environment, right? Yeah. Unless you go to an alternate vendor, you know, that still provides to you that private cloud experience, but at a much more reasonable and affordable price point.
Was there any justification given for that price increase, or just why not?
Yeah, you know, I think historically, I mean, there were a lot of good business reasons, I think, right? Because I think VMware's pricing historically had a lot of variability, you know, across the board, across various enterprises, because they have about 300,000 customers by this point, right? And there wasn't a good discipline and consistency maintained from the public knowledge that we know. And as a result, the company wasn't getting the best benefit for the, you know, the massive adoption of the virtualization stack that they've had now. So I think some of that was definitely justified, but I think some of that is just the Broadcom strategy, right? This is what, you know, they're very good at doing with some of the previous companies they've acquired as well. And then they've publicly said that their preference is to do business with the top 2,000 companies, right? And, you know, for the rest of the customers, let the ecosystem benefit from that. So I think it's sort of a win-win for both them as well as, you know.
Yeah, it's a win for vendors, not necessarily customers. Yes,
I agree with that.
And we'll come to that in a second, because you're not the only company that sort of jumped in to fill in that gap. But just one sort of final thing for people who maybe work for different sorts of companies and are more used to public cloud. And, you know, public cloud offers lots of tools and resources and APIs and things like this for privacy, for segregation, for regulatory handling. So why does someone need private cloud? You know, what are some of the reasons why people who want private cloud don't trust or don't want to use public cloud?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think there is probably three factors that go into it, right? Like, one is definitely the trust or compliance reason. I think increasingly public clouds have done very well with it, like you said, right? Like, there's government cloud now, they have some of the best security. I think there are still environments that need to be completely air-gapped or must have a higher level of security, or enterprises that, you know, don't necessarily want to do business with one or two other public cloud providers for, again, you know, competitive or trust or other reasons. It kind of falls into that. becomes an important aspect for them. So that's one, the, you know, the security, trust, compliance, etc. The second one is cost. It definitely is still today significantly by, you know, like a very large magnitude, cost effective to run your infrastructure in the private cloud than in the public cloud. And especially as now the GPUs are going to get added to them increasingly. Yeah. GPUs are already extremely expensive and it's very difficult to acquire them. But even as they get commoditized, they are going to remain fairly expensive, at least for a while. And that, I think, is going to almost set the level of the playing fields for public versus private cloud, because now you really, for your budget to allow you to run GPUs at scale, you really have to find the most cost-effective destination for those GPUs. And that also brings, we think, private clouds back into bigger focus. So, but that's the second reason, right? Cost. I think the third reason also is and this really matters to us in a sort of a vision for the future way, because if you think that all of the world's infrastructure is only going to run into three large public cloud providers, think of what that results in, right? It results in a very commoditized, very sort of homogenized hardware software stack. So think of all of the storage ecosystem, for example, of lots of companies innovating, building best of breed storage arrays. All of that innovation goes away if your infrastructure is just going to run in the public cloud, because they're going to choose their own storage to run that. But that's not necessarily the best option for the end user, right? So we also really believe that private clouds are going to continue to stay relevant, because that's a place where end user gets to choose best of breed technology to run their software on, in terms of server, storage, networking, etc. So I think it's these three kind of factors.
Doesn't private cloud suit everybody? Like, or are there certain sort of smaller companies, smaller use cases where it's just it's more expensive, it's more hassle? Like, you know, I'm old enough to remember the days where we kind of all connected to our own servers and things, and DigitalOcean was sort of the company that revolutionized that for hobbyists to and up kind of developers. But, you know, could everybody benefit from a private cloud or not really?
Yeah, no, I mean, not really, right? I definitely think if you're starting out as a startup, you know, when we started, even we were starting as a private cloud company, but even we ran some of our hosted infrastructure in the public cloud. That just made the most business sense for us, right? Only after we grew to a certain size, we brought private cloud for our own infrastructure, brought in private cloud. So it definitely makes sense for small to mid-sized companies that are looking to grow fast to not have to get into their own infrastructure management. But, you know, I think the risky aspect is that you continue to grow and you continue to scale, and yet you don't revisit your infrastructure strategy. And that many times comes to bite organizations. Yeah.
Okay. So now let's finally switch back to Platform 9 in a bit more detail. You have existed for 12 years now, I guess.
Yeah.
And there are a handful of other vendors that sort of stepped into this VMware-sized hole over the past year or so. So how did you, as someone who's been kind of doing this for a bit longer, what did you do to keep up with these new entrants? You might have new ideas, you know, they've less to lose, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, especially in the private cloud space, you know, if you think of VMware, for example, they've built this really kind of broad tech stack over multiple decades, right? So while the innovation in the container space has happened for the most part in open source, right? So the best of breed container software is really Kubernetes. And that makes it easy for a new company to take Kubernetes and sort of start commercializing it. That's not quite true on the open source side.
Right.
And even for us, even as we've taken best of breed open source to build our private cloud platform, there is a significant amount of IP we've had to invest in it to really make it enterprise grade and make sure that it covers all the required features. And really that at this point benefits us, because when someone is looking for a private cloud alternative, when they're looking to switch from VMware, they really need the requirement. And we see that with many enterprises, is that it still must meet, it must have like these 10 enterprise features from VMware Plus that they're very accustomed to using. Yeah. And we've kind of spent these past 10 years really building those out. We've spent these past 10 years making sure we integrate with every single storage networking stack that's out there, right? Mm. And so that kind of gives, you know, a company like us an advantage.
Okay. And actually, I was just interested, you talking about kind of best of breed open source. If someone was going to start doing some of this on their own, what are some of those tools? Is that OpenStack or is it other things? Or I think that's the main. Yeah.
So it's definitely parts of OpenStack, but not all of it, right? So KVM is at the core, the hypervisor technology, right? But then for us, at least, so our flagship product is called Private Cloud Director. That's our private cloud alternative for VMware. And that's built using some key components of OpenStack. And one of the big benefits of that is OpenStack also created for storage and network integrations. It created sort of this open source ecosystem and a standard for integration, right? So if you, as a storage vendor, adhere to the, you know, the Cinder, OpenStack Cinder standard for storage integration, that meant that any Cinder compatible private cloud environment can integrate with your storage platform easily. And many vendors have done that. And so we benefit from that. And so we use, you know, OpenStack Cinder for storage. We use components of OpenStack Neutron networking. Mm-hmm. But then we've completely built the cluster management layer, which is really the key part for any private cloud infrastructure environment, right? Which includes, you know, ability to manage multiple servers in a clustered environment where you do, you know, automated live migrations of machines behind the scenes to really get the optimal utilization of that entire cluster. We build features like, again, high availability and many other such components. So a lot of that IP we've built. A lot of the orchestration components, we've decided to choose Terraform, for example.
Okay.
Again, as best of breed open source for doing more of the GitOps style automation for your orchestration, right? So, and we use Prometheus, Grafana, again, the best stack for monitoring and metrics collection. So that's really what we mean by, you know, best of breed open source.
So forgive my ignorance on kind of the VMware side of things, but then I'm assuming there is a possibility to have a sort of mixture of VMware-like technologies, but also Kubernetes and its kind of ecosystem as well. They can integrate together fairly well these days.
So you're saying, meaning get virtualization along with Kubernetes to build a VMware-like stack?
Yeah, I mean, my main experience is Kubernetes. So sometimes when people talk VMware and virtual machines, you know, my main experience with virtual machines is like firing up a Windows virtual machine on my Mac to do some things. So sometimes I sort of understand the technology, but I'm never 100% sure what it quite looks like. Yeah. So I'm just kind of wondering, you know, if I have an array of machines, you're talking about orchestration, can I orchestrate them with something like Kubernetes, or is it something more custom?
Yeah, no, I think that's very interesting. So Kubernetes also did add VM management.
Okay, right.
3 years or so ago now, right? And so
shows you how often I've looked into that then.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's only a part you get exposed to if you're really interested in VM management. You know, if you're looking to run containers, then that part doesn't become as relevant to you. But yeah, so Kubernetes ecosystem has invested in this component called KubeWord, and we actually ran KubeWord internally and really evaluated it as whether that should become our alternative technology behind the scenes for running virtual machines. We decided to not go that route because, you know, I think primarily because what happens is for virtualization administrators that have been running large-scale virtual machine environments, a lot of the cloud-native constructs are still very foreign to them, right?
Yeah. They
require a certain significant translation, which especially if you're looking for an alternate, you know, private cloud platform, you know, that sometimes becomes too big of a jump. You want to minimize your risk across all areas, right? And so being able to find a stack that provides more of a familiar experience to what you're used to with VMware helps minimize that risk to some extent. And so that was one reason why we did not go with KubeWord. The other one is that even the ecosystem is still limited in terms of all of the capabilities that you can still provide, you know, for a virtualization stack.
Okay. And sort of very recently, well, actually a month or so ago now, but let's say recently, you talked about, you had a press release here, migrating thousands of virtual machines to your cloud at 1/10 of the cost. So I'm assuming this is kind of your magic sauce. This is the bits you do. I mean, obviously that's a kind of generalized number. You know, it depends is the classic answer to everything.
Yeah.
But what are some of what are some of the positive and negative things that surprised you on these migration paths? You know, what things were easier than you thought? What things were harder than you thought for some clients?
Yeah. No, I think, you know, we jailbreak, that's the project you were talking about. And we built that. And it's completely open source, by the way. And so anyone can use it to migrate from VMware to an OpenStack API compatible environment.
Yeah.
We, you know, primarily test it with Private Cloud Director, which is our stack, but it is out there for anyone to use. And, you know, that was one of our, you know, back when we really started thinking about this space around the Broadcom migrations and how do we best help enterprises. Migration really, you know, from our perspective, it was at the, you know, the top of the set of problems that enterprises would want to solve. And if you look at what's available out there today, migrations are primarily done through large-scale professional services exercises, right? Where you hire an army of engineers that'll actually take your environments, you know, one VM or a few VMs at a time. And that's the reason why they become such expensive, such an expensive exercise. And also one where you don't have full visibility into how long it'll take. So it can extend for months or years. And that really, you know, extends your risk pretty significantly. So with VJailbreak, we've put a lot of focus on migration through software automation. Yeah. And so it's something we're really excited about, where we can take a vSphere cluster today and literally one physical server at a time, we dehydrate that cluster, okay? We port over your storage and networking configuration over to Private Cloud Director because we understand it fully. Then we will step-by-step rehydrate it, you know, bring that same server on Private Cloud Director, then migrate VMs, few hundred at a time, and bring them over to Private Cloud Director. Right. So, and all of this while you don't, you know, not even an IP address of the virtual machine changes. The VM, you know, gets an almost live migration. There is a short sort of pause at the end, but we do change block tracking and migration of the content as it changes. So you can keep running your production environments while these migrations are happening. And that's really the key to the secret sauce behind the scenes with Visual.
Yeah. I'm looking at it right now. And actually, now I start to understand some terminology here. VMDKs, QCOW2s, QCOW2s. These are things I recognize from doing a lot of like more desktop virtual machine devices. Yeah. And actually, you have a form. I'm assuming you could do something with Terraform or OpenTofu, I suppose we should be calling it now, that kind of thing as well.
Yeah. That's
right. Yeah. Cool. Okay. And yeah, did you hit any complexities, like something that just was very hard to migrate, something really niche? And I can imagine there'd be quite a few customers with some, I don't know, some antiquated things running that you never thought you'd expect to see anymore or something like that. I don't know.
No, absolutely. So I think, you know, the one thing that definitely stumped our team and something that we recently worked on is raw device mappings. So VMware has a certain way to do raw disk mappings for virtual machines, specifically certain Windows VMs, et cetera. We had to sort of invest in building an equivalent in the private cloud director world. I think most virtual machines at this point, at least in the, you know, private cloud director space, they will use, you know, volumes. They integrate directly with the storage and start mounting and using volumes, right, from your storage arrays. But if you are specifically reliant on something like RDM, then we had to really spend that effort building that out. So I think these kinds of cases definitely appear, right? Because like you said, there's been, you know, these are all bespoke clouds built by enterprises using specific key features that may not be the most popular 10 ones. And so it's always work in progress, but we're very committed to this, right? We think this is one of our biggest differentiators and also enablers for the ecosystem. And so we have an R&D team that actively works on this tool. And
cool. Now, for people who are interested in sort of experimenting with these things, I must admit, I was surprised. I was just sort of digging around. You do actually have a community edition. So what are some of the differences between the community edition and the non-community edition then? What you have kind of some open source tools, you have some things you add on top, and then there's obviously some more things you add on top for the non-community edition. But what's the main differences between those two editions?
Yeah, so the community edition is completely free to use. It is the private cloud director, you know, with the limit that you can run it with one region. And then there are some limitations in terms of when you enable our core cluster management features, right? Like the DRS equivalent, we have a DRR feature or HA that there's a limit on how many hosts you can run it on. But otherwise, you know, completely free to run. There are no other feature gates, and you download it, install it on a single machine. So you can easily power your home labs and potentially run, you know, less than 50 node or so environment. Very easily with the community edition.
Okay. And what's next? You've probably had quite a busy year with all the sort of VMware related things, but what's next? What's on the roadmap for the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah. So lots of stuff, you know, we spoke about VisualBrake. That's definitely front and center. You know, we want VisualBrake to continue to be the best tool in the industry for doing migrations. We really want to de-risk that aspect of the migration. But beyond that, right, in the private cloud director, we're looking to build really what we think private clouds of tomorrow, right? So VMware migration is a problem that's in focus today. It will stay in focus for maybe next 2 to 3 years. But beyond that, we want private cloud director to be the best place for running an equivalent of a public cloud-like environment using infrastructure of your choice, CPU and GPU. So best-of-breed GPU support, making sure you can get the best utilization out of those GPUs, right? Through, you know, not just GPU sharing, you know, MIG or vGPU, but just overall, how do we get the best utilization out of those resources is very important for us in our, you know, cluster concept. Then we've been actively building a layer of PaaS services in our private cloud, right? We really want you to consume your database as a service, your object store, and all of those components as a service. We just, in the recent release, added firewall, load balancer as a service. We're about to add VPN as a service. So really building this to be the, you know, the best private cloud destination for enterprises running, looking to run at scale is, you know, is what's part of the roadmap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Cool. One last question. Is there a meaning behind the name, or just some cool name that sounded good at the time? Just wondering. Yeah.
Yeah, so we've been huge Harry Potter fans, and Platform 9 actually comes from
'93.
Yeah. And so the analogy is, you know, just like in the Harry Potter world, if you don't know the meaning of that spot, then it's just yet another spot on the train station. But for those who do, it's like your portal into this magical world. You know, we think Platform 9 is your portal into the beautiful world of delightful private cloud. So that's where the name comes from.
A beautiful world full of weird language and strange magical concepts.
Yes.
Awesome. All right, then. Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris. Okay. You had a great time.
Out of all the services and tools I mentioned in these little ads, I think one of the ones I use the most and for the longest is SetApp. It's a Mac and iOS subscription service for applications from MacPaw. I had the great privilege of visiting MacPaw's office in Kyiv way back in 2017 or so, and SetApp has also been running for a good few years now. I think I regularly use on a daily basis Timing, Clean My Mac, Bartender, Note Plan, MindNode, CleanShot Receipts, Ulysses, and yes, a lot more. You can see I really love it. I could go on. Anyway, there are so many cool applications that if I was paying individually for them, it would cost me a fair bit, but SetApp is just $10 a month, and they're always adding more applications to it. If you're in the European Union, they also have an alternative app store for iOS too. If you're interested in finding out more, getting a discount off of the subscription, and of course earning a little bit for the show, then head on over to go.christianchiller.com/setup.
So I gather Root is a new name for something I have encountered before.
Sort of, yes, it is.
So let's start with that. What is Root.io?
Root.io is a company that focuses on automated vulnerability remediation. Mm-hmm. We have a SaaS platform and technology that sort of runs behind the scenes of that SaaS technology that can patch container vulnerabilities automatically. On the input side of our system, our SaaS is a registry, which has containers, and someone's CI/CD process can trigger us. We can access those container images. We assess the vulnerabilities and the packages that are used in that image.
Yeah.
We then apply a set of patches per what we call a patching plan, which seeks to nullify vulnerabilities by trying to replace the vulnerable packages with packages that are patched. And then we produce a new image from that, where all those upgrades and patches live in one layer of the container, sort of the last layer of the new container. All the other layers are the same. We emit that new container back to the registry. Folks can then run and test. And the kind of key to this technology is twofold. One, this SaaS technology that we have that's familiar to you. If you remember the slim days in decomposing and recomposing containers and looking inside of them and inspecting them and learning all about them, we have a lot of history doing that from our old Docker Slim days. Mm-hmm. But the new mode, rather than removing packages like Docker Slim did to make vulnerabilities go away, instead, we replace the vulnerable packages with packages that have been fixed.
Okay.
Behind the scenes, I mentioned we have some technology, and that is some agentic AI capabilities we have and a very smart and capable research team that knows how to create patches. And they do so by finding patches in later versions of those same libraries and pulling them back and backporting them and by other means. But in general, we have a lot of patches for libraries that are not patched otherwise.
Got it.
And we have those sitting on the shelf, and we use those to make our customers' containers remediated.
I'd like to dig into that technology side a bit more in a moment, but I actually just wanted to go a little bit back to the history, because I feel like I met Slim last time at KubeCon in Amsterdam, which was not that long ago.
That's right.
What happened? Why the name change?
The name change, we used to take the approach, as I mentioned earlier, by removing things from containers that weren't being used. That was the Slim idea behind Slim.ai. And since we've found a better way to remediate images. We decided that Slim name was great when we were a company that slimmed things, but we really wanted to kind of refresh the way we present ourselves, you know, due to the fact that we've had a pretty significant redirection in how we how we solve the problem. And that's it. We just thought this name would be more fitting.
And is it mostly the same team, or did you kind of refresh a lot of things?
We have a number of people in that are still with us. Slim was a mostly remote company built during COVID. We've since decided to consolidate resources in a couple of development centers because people want to work back in the office. And we found that it's more productive for early stage companies to be together working in a room. So we're a hybrid company now, but you know, we have several of the same people throughout that change. The way we're approaching things now and the current marketscape for remediation has really propelled us. So things are really exciting here.
And I feel like even before Slim, was it Docker Shim or something? Like
Docker Slim.
Docker Slim.
Slim was a sort of pulled from the name Docker Slim, exactly. Yeah. And we used a lot of that technology and know-how back then, especially the slimming part. We found that users were facing an important problem.
Yeah.
And more, this was less about, I'd say, minimizing container images and became more about vulnerability remediation and security. And that was something that evolved with us. And the markets evolved as well. And we know that, you know, from our ardent users, the goal was to remove vulnerabilities, get vulnerabilities out of these images, because security was a top of mind problem. And like 93% of all vulnerabilities never get remediated, not ever. And so we really wanted to tackle that problem with AI coming along and becoming a way that people write code and really proliferating software development and more code getting generated. That code's not necessarily secure. In fact, we found the opposite.
Yeah.
So we really wanted to find a way to automate away the problem of vulnerability remediation for organizations. Shift left's also sort of failed because development teams really need to focus on writing code and building value. And then they don't really like these kind of security tasks. So we've tried to automate that away for our customers.
And it makes a degree of sense because the sort of vulnerability in containers and other dependencies is a big industry. But that's also the negative. It's a big industry. You've got a lot of competitors in this space. Some of what you said explains, I think, some of what you're doing differently to me. But what else would you see as the points of difference you're adding to some of the other competitors?
Sure. And that's in general, vulnerability management is a very large market space.
Yeah.
And container vulnerability management, I'll leave that as the kind of term for the space we're in, is very fragmented in some ways. There are runtime security vendors for this, AquaSec and others, Palo Alto are those. There are vulnerability management and detection companies, the Palo Alto Twistlock, Sneak, et cetera. And very few of them have the ability to do, I'll call it wholesale automated remediation like we do. So in our sliver, there's not many competitors. The market vastly spends on two parts. The lion's share of the dollars in vulnerability management for containers is spent on detection. Mm-hmm. And therein lies a problem, right? Like we get long lists of vulnerabilities in our container images. And with runtime, we know where they're running. Mm-hmm. But automation has really, for removing those vulnerabilities, has really lagged. In our competitive space, you've got a few different approaches. You've got a vendor or two that do this slimming approach. We're just going to make your container as small as possible, your container as small as possible, and that's going to remove some vulnerabilities. There'll still be some left. That's up to you to deal with, but you get a smaller container. That approach has some brittleness because it's really hard to tell what should be running in those containers. We found that out from our slim days, that there's a lot of break fix and necessarily a lot of testing required. And then lots of organizations lack the DevOps maturity to really test their containers enough. So that's an approach with some challenges. The second approach is companies like ChainGuard. They tell you, we're just going to build these zero vuln images on our own operating system called Wolfie.
Yeah.
And you should change all your base images to our image, and we're just going to own the problem and make it go away. That has challenges as well, because it's not easy to rebase something to what is ostensibly a proprietary version of Alpine. If I'm using Debian with Node, this stuff breaks.
Yeah.
It's slower. And I've got to ask my engineering teams to refab everything. Some companies can afford to do that and have done so successfully, but that's a big heavy lift effort. I'll contrast Root's approach, the third approach, which is automated patching. Our job and our goal is to let you use your containers. So first of all, you don't have to change your base image. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to pull things out of your images. We're going to surgically patch the things that have vulnerabilities in them with the smallest amount of code possible in that change. I talked about our backported patches. This allows you to stay on the version of the software you're on if you want to, mm-hmm. but have it be vulnerability free. We also can do selective upgrades for you if we believe there's a really low risk of it breaking your image. And we do that as well. So this patching plan has low risk to breakage. Your app will work the way it did. And these are the containers you know and love. If you're on Debian or you're on Ubuntu or you're on Red Hat and you've got a workflow and build chains and scripting and all that to deal with that ecosystem, you can stay with it. So you don't have to do any wholesale upgrades. The other thing is where, you know, the name says it, automated vulnerability remediation, where we do have detection capabilities, but the goal is to get you from whatever you have to zero, high, critical, and mediums. And that's mm-hmm. what our tool drives. So we don't shift left because we just remove the work for you in your CICD phase, I'll call it. Sort of after you get an image that you want to push to production, in that phase, usually it's starting with your base images. We apply our automation. You can run us, you know, several times a week or every time you want to build, and you know you'll always get the maximum vulnerability reduction mm-hmm. with very low risk of breaking and no work for your developers. That's the key.
Yeah.
And that's how we differentiate.
Two more questions kind of around comparing to other products, and then I want to dig a little bit more into some of the patching you mentioned.
Sure.
So firstly, I just wondered, are you actually also maintaining your own vulnerability database, or are you pulling those from other common sources?
We do to some degree. We don't. So we start with Trivi as a scanner inside of our system.
Yep.
We like Trivi because it has high recall, meaning it very low false negatives. It's known to be verbose. When you're in the patching mode like we are, knowing about a few more vulnerabilities isn't a problem because we'll patch them away. So that's cool. But we also have to keep a database that knows about our patches, right? Because the world doesn't always know about our patches. We have some nomenclature we use in the patch semantic versioning that identifies ours. We also provide VEX statements for everything we do. So when we modify your image, we create a new SBOM for you. Mm-hmm. And we also create VEX statements so that you can use that VEX statement to inform other scanners and starting to work with scanner vendors also to incorporate knowledge of our patches. But we keep our own database for that purpose. So it's the standard Trivi database, I think is very competent with some knowledge of the work that we've done to do this vulnerability remediation.
Okay. And the one remaining one, you mentioned ChainGuard in there and their sort of custom images, but you also do have a small library of your own secured images too.
I can tell you about those.
Yeah. Just to wonder, like, is that just like it's just another thing. It's not a fundamental.
They're free.
It's just,
So, you know, as with any endeavor like this, we want to provide the ability for users who may be on vastly outdated images to start with something better.
Yeah.
We give them away for free. We sell patching automation, remediation automation. Yeah. We don't sell images, but you're free to use them if you'd like. And we've curated them such that they are what we believe are well-maintained images. We draw them from Dr. Hub and other maintainers' areas. Sometimes those images from those areas have, you know, I would say, they're more like developer-friendly images. They may have package managers and others. We strip that stuff out. If you want to start with that other image and have a developer-friendly image, you can always switch to our base and get an image that's been kind of hardened and curated for like a production grade image. And then you can run that image confidently through our system and patch it. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessary. We can work with any image you have. We support Debian, Ubuntu, and Alpine images today.
Yep.
And that's our focus. But we're always expanding the set we do and also climbing up into some of the other I'll call it application packages as well. Like one we'll be releasing soon is our NPM patches coming out, Java patches.
Okay, interesting.
JavaScript patches, yes.
Yep. So the skeptic here might say, I mean, I know it's not a company, grounds for a company per se, but wouldn't it be better just to contribute these patches upstream? I mean, or maybe you do. I don't know.
We everything we do is completely transparent. So these patches are in a public hub that anyone can get to and see.
Okay.
If you're so inclined to want to use them and rebuild things yourself, it's hard to do. And most organizations aren't good at this kind of automated patching and image maintenance. So our SaaS platform makes that pain go away. These backports, they don't exist often. We make them exist, right? That's kind of one of our big contributions. And oftentimes we will go back and try to, you know, do some contributions. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. A lot of these libraries that we're patching, the authors already made a fix. It's just not in the library you're using. Meaning they might have version 1.2.1 of their thing. They patched in 1.3.
Yeah.
To them, this is a solved problem. Mm. But to the user of library 1.2.1 who depends on that version, upgrading is painful, right? It breaks things. So the goal here is to kind of help organizations navigate through the waters of a version change, right?
Yep.
And getting them to be to a secure place all the time, regardless of their software dependencies, their code dependencies, all of that. This is one of the big, unique challenges that really foil, I'd say, patching regime, right?
Yep.
It's like, what if it breaks, right? Or I don't want to take the time to do the upgrade now. I want to do it on my own timeline. But the moment between I'm vulnerable and I can do the upgrade are often sparse. People forget to do it. This is what Golden Image teams are supposed to be doing. But so many organizations just never reach the level of maturity and efficacy to have this be something that meets the SLAs. FedRAMP SLAs, 7 days for critical vulnerabilities to be fixed. That's a really difficult timeline to meet. And that's what we're really trying to help organizations do is shrink those risk windows and meet these compliance objectives.
Is there ever a possibility that Root might be able to say, you know, we can make this patch for you, but based on some other kind of advanced code analysis, we actually think you can upgrade to the proper version reasonably confidently as well?
Yeah, part of our patch planning is actually trying to make some of those decisions.
Yeah.
So we always prefer to do the not root patch, the standard in-stream patch. We believe that's always the best way to go. And if we can make a decision like that for you confidently, we'll actually do the upgrade rather than using our patch.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not the thing you said. It's awesome and it sounds great. It's very non-trivial to do, as you know.
Sure.
I know it's extremely non-trivial, right? We're getting better and better at it. I think I'm actually, with AI code interpretation, this is actually one of those things that I think is really hopeful for me, that we can mature to the point where this kind of sophisticated interpretation of effectively risk, but basically code compatibility is something that we could get to. We're doing a lot of research in that area. I did mention that earlier that, you know, in our software factory, it's a software factory full of agents who are studying code and looking for patches and, you know, autonomous agents, kind of modern LLM-based agents. Turns out a lot of the tasks you do when you're trying to make patches are actually quite suitable with the capabilities of LLMs today. So I'm hopeful, and we do that whenever we can, whenever we feel it's confident. With of course the fallback of knowing that you know, if we can patch the exact version you're using and make very few lines of code change and be able to test it well, that's probably your safest path to a working system. But we'd like to do that as often as possible.
Okay.
Just described it's virtuous.
And you have mentioned the new phrase of the era, AI, several times, and it does make a lot of sense. But we're talking security. And one of the things we all kind of know that a lot of AI tools can be guilty of is making things up.
Sure.
And sort of making things up.
Yeah.
When it comes to security is risky. So how do you put guardrails around that?
So when you're thinking about AI in this frame, and I would say for any software task, this happens to be a security-oriented software development task. But regardless, I think it's it's important to remember that the AI parts of this are augmentative to human beings.
Yeah.
And I think that's the smart way to think about it today. Two types of augmentation. You can have effectively the sort of, you know, half horse, half man augmentation, which is the horse part is the AI and it's really good at certain tasks that you can trust it to do on its own. But the brain of the animal is still the man, and they have to, you know, control the automaton, right? So that they know they're basically the overseer. Another mode is what I call a cybernetic organism, which is a human and a machine working together. With this patching thing, we've built sort of this cybernetic organism. The humans are the rationale trusted actor in that entity, but boy, these machines can do a lot of work and do it pretty well. You just need to be able to set yourself up so that it's really apparent and obvious when they've made a mistake. And in this realm, the way you do that is you make use of tests, especially tests that have been developed by the author of the library. It's always seeking, I'll call it test-driven patch generation, test-driven development. Can the human understand the test objectives? And be part of really verifying that those tests are passing and that there's no chance effectively for mistakes. So, you know, it's really that kind of hierarchy of risk management in this process. It's humans always approve. They always review. They always review things in, I'll call it a GitOps fashion.
Like, yeah.
No code cannot be checked in that we plan to ship to our customers that isn't reviewed and authorized by humans, first of all.
But
we can extract the tests from the upstream libraries, we do.
Just
and we run them. And we do that with integrity, which means like we want to run the build and test scripts to the letter of what the author of that package said is right. And so yeah, it's sort of that hierarchy of decision making and checks and balances that we do. And in the end, it's always, measure thrice, cut once on this sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe let's go back a little bit to how you got here. How old is Root now then?
Root itself is about almost exactly a year old.
Okay.
Since we rebranded and sort of doubled down on this patching-based approach. Yeah, we did a lot of user and customer interaction. The tool app.root.io is free for anyone to try and use. We're still allowing people to come on and use it. As I mentioned, we have all those images and we continue to develop more of these images. So we're very loving of free user adoption and testing. So anyone can do that. Mm. That's been available for about, I'd say, 5 months of that year. We were retooling and doing some, you know, technology refactoring as we made the shift. Our customers came along for the ride with us and have been very happy about it.
Okay.
And really getting a lot of great customer adoption and interest, because as we've talked about, the vulnerability remediation challenge is huge now, and the industry is really kind of awake to that.
Yeah, the pivot is the sort of famous a strategy sometimes in technology companies, or in many companies, but technology companies, just as someone who's done one recently, like how much of your previous work you were allowed to, was it possible to reuse? How much did you have to sort of start again?
The foundation, so good thing, right? We've always been a container processing company. Mm. So a lot of the plumbing and know-how and engineering work, we were able to benefit deeply from that as our core of it. And with these things, so much of it is plumbing. It's so much of it is behind, you know, it's the processing engine behind the scenes. As we talked about, we've been our team and our technical, I'll call it stack, has been pretty good at manipulating container images, handling them, pulling them apart, putting them back together, looking at the vulnerabilities inside. So a lot of that is high reuse. And so for us, I'd say it wasn't a 180 degree turn. It was more of a 45 degree course correction, and the momentum continued to go sort of along the vector, directional vector that we were going. Yeah. So it was much easier for us. And
it wasn't the most dramatic of pivots.
Right. Yeah, we did switch to becoming. I think the company that developed Slack was a gaming company. They happened to have Slack as a tool internally. Yeah. The gaming company failed, but some of the engineers said, hey, this thing, Slack, is better than anything we've ever used for doing work among developers. Let's make that into a product. And voila, multi-billion dollar company, right? But I'd say that's probably a little bit more of a directional departure than ours was.
It's fair enough. So you've just come back from, the team anyway. I'm not sure if you in particular, but just came back from KubeCon EU.
I was there. I was there.
It was the first one I wasn't able to make, which is annoying.
Well, that's too bad.
I just wanted to, it's a good excuse or something to kind of round up the conversation with. One of your team published a post on container security trends from the event to sort of watch out for. What would be, let's say, the two most significant and important container security trends to you that you think people either don't know about or should know about at the moment?
Yeah, I think first of all, KubeCon EU was wonderful. It was really busy and active, and it was really, you know, I think it's long live KubeCon. I think the energy there and the amount of traffic we had through our booth was fantastic and had a lot of chance to talk to people. I would say that one of the key trends, right, is moving away from that you know, vulnerability detection mindset. Mm-hmm, so many security regimes want you counting vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
But I would say even in places where there aren't hard SLAs, even compliance-driven kind of mindsets, folks are trying to get security to be a more front and center part of their development operations. And I saw a lot of DevSecOps teams come to our booth.
Yeah.
This role and this idea that we can automate security operations around containers is becoming, I think, a top line investment, and folks are really doubling down there. So it's about security automation for containers, and really about automating away tasks that are not
doing
that developers don't need to do.
Yeah.
The shift left is kind of waning, in my opinion, especially around container security. So that's one that's kind of an undercurrent, but I saw this in spades. And then the second one is, it's not so much, it's a companion to that.
Yeah.
Pressure from all sides about being able to prove security through outcomes for container images is kind of key. You see, in the United States, PCI DSS 4 is starting to have more teeth around outcomes, meaning like if you're running applications, they should be vulnerability free. And if you don't, bad things, you know, there'll be penalties. I've seen this happen across the board. And that really is starting to, for me, mean that I think the world at large is feeling a lot more risk coming to bear in the form of like ransomware and bad outcomes, and security is becoming mandated. This kind of mandate pressure is driving behavior, and I think that's driving some of this DevSecOps behavior.
Yeah, I think that's something that I know more from a European context, and regulation in the US is sort of a bit all over the place right now, but it's something that everyone is talking about.
and of course, the vast undercurrent, you can't go anywhere without AI popping up in various contexts, which is causing
issues and as well as solving problems, of course.
Yeah,
I think I saw that on the list on this blog post.
Yeah.
Where did it go? Where did the blog post go?
AI is
non-human entity management. Non-human entity confoundment as well, maybe.
That's right. So It's really a mixed bag of opportunity and risk, right? AI. On one hand, folks are developing code and are reaching levels of productivity never quite before seen, which is a great top line opportunity and really drives productivity and leverage and business opportunity. Yeah. The downside of that is, boy, we were having trouble keeping up with the pace of software development and risk and a lot of what AI, you know, emits from a code perspective is mimicking other code that already existed.
Yeah.
It doesn't know whether it's risky or not, really.
Exactly.
And so now you can generate so much code so fast, it's easy to be careless and create more. I mean, I'd say it's like this inverted curve, right? You have this high productivity on one end and this high risk generation on the other.
Hyper productivity and hyper
How do you manage that? and the answer is not going to be to have developers review every line of code. So we need a wholesale shift in how we think about managing security in the age of AI code generation. And that's, I'd say, it's an undercurrent, but I'd say maybe like, you know, in the sea, you've got like the wave height and then you've got all the water beneath. I think the wave height is the changes in like perspective and then all the water under the sea is that undercurrent of what's happening.
So one final question. I mean, root.io is relatively new. What's next? KubeCon EU next year. What do you hope to be showing, discussing, doing?
Yeah, so my simple goal is you know, high level thing that drove me to start the company and to continue, you know, with all the energy I have for this business is that I want to make it really easy for security teams to ship vulnerability free code to production. That's my passion. It's a problem I've been wanting to solve, you know, and been acting to solve for a long time, you know, raising money, investing my time and building products. By this time next year, I would love it if it was as simple as connect us to your registry and stop thinking about curating golden images, that we can just do that for you on the images you have in the context of your applications in a way that your people understand. And there's no container we can't do that for. And I think that's my goal by this time next year.
I was thinking a really dumb, stupid name you could have picked instead. It would be like Midas. You don't need one golden thing because everything is
there. There you go. That's right. The golden image team. Yes, the finger just touches the image and makes it gold. I like that. I got that for free. Thank you very much. It's definitely worth the 10 times the price of admission. Very cool and always fun. Always fun talking. Hopefully awesome. That makes sense.
Yep. And, awesome. And people can obviously try some things for free if they're interested in giving things a go. So
And anybody can always find me on LinkedIn, and I'll always be willing to help people get through this journey.
Awesome. Thank you very much for your time, John.
Thanks, Chris.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.